We may tend to jump to conclusions and pass judgment on those who seem to miss the obvious lessons that seem like it should hit them between the eyes. But Nebuchadnezzar is one of those that we may be inclined to judge. After all, he found Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in chapter 1 to be 10 times smarter than all of the other wise men in his orbit. He knew that they had chosen to obey their God and risk being accused of defying him. He then found out that Daniel was the only one in chapter 2 who was able to tell him what he had dreamed and interpret the meaning of the dream. And of course, Daniel gave full credit to his God. And Nebuchadnezzar himself said this, "Surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings." So what Nebuchadnezzar does next in today's lesson in chapter 3 of Daniel's story seems really incredible. But I believe we're not actually in a position, as much as we think we are, to judge Nebuchadnezzar so harshly. When Jesus said this, "Do not judge or you too will be judged, for in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you." Can that possibly apply even to Nebuchadnezzar? Well, let's read chapter 3 of Daniel, and I'll just warn you to be ready for some self-examination. We'll ask whether we are ever in the position of Nebuchadnezzar. Of course, we will also ask whether we are ever in the position of the heroes of the story, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So let's read. "King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all of the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, 'Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace.' Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshiped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came." Astrologers were a part of the wise men that Daniel has been put in charge of. "At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up.' Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, 'Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand?'" There's where we feel like maybe he's a slow learner, right? "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, your majesty." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed, their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. All right, so that's a great lesson just in the reading. Okay, so the kids are dismissed. If you want to go to your Bible hour, you can go if you want to, but you don't have to. So either way. By the way, starting next week, is it? We're going to split the Bible hour for the kids into age groups. So the older kids will be with Brenda, the younger kids will be with Betty, and they'll be able to enjoy a little more specificity as to their age-appropriate needs. So my first response is, you know, what's in the title that I chose? You know, how in the world could Nebuchadnezzar have been such a slow learner? How did he miss the point of those first 2 events in chapters 1 and 2, along with the close association that we would think he had with Daniel? Daniel now serves with him in the royal court and is actually put in charge of all of the wise men. And so why wasn't he at least asking Daniel what he thought about this idea of his to make this image and make this decree? You know, on the one hand, he might have avoided asking Daniel about this because he really knew what Daniel would say. We think he should have known that it was completely off base, you know, even without needing to ask Daniel, though, don't we? Well, the reason that we cannot judge Nebuchadnezzar fairly is the same reason that we cannot judge each other fairly, and that is that we have never walked in the shoes of anyone else. And we certainly have not walked in the shoes of Nebuchadnezzar or anyone like him. I've never had the option of ordering an image to be made out of gold and ordering every people of all nation, all people of every nation to bow down and worship the image. And you've never had that kind of power either. So You know, and we've heard Lord Acton's words many times, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. We hear those words and we like to apply them to the leaders that we judge to have the most power and who we believe have abused their power the most. People not quite as bad as Nebuchadnezzar, maybe, in most cases, but in some cases, Hitler, you know, Mao Zedong, they've ordered millions of people to die, so at least as bad as Nebuchadnezzar, I would say. But what we usually fail to do is think of how it applies to us. I don't have much power, and what power I do have is certainly not absolute power. Well, we will do much better to forget that second line, okay, and focus on the first two words, power corrupts. None of us have absolute power. Nebuchadnezzar thought he did. Some of his wise men and all of his military leaders certainly wanted him to believe that they believed that he did. But what he learns is that he has far less power than he has been allowed to believe that he has. Now we, on the other hand, may need to learn that we have more power than we think. We may need to learn that we, at some level, have access to the same power that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had access to. What was the test that these three faced? What were they tempted to do? Well, they were tempted to literally bow down to what their culture demanded. The Jews were one of many subcultures, as we've looked at before, that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to coexist. Remember, this is called pluralism. Pluralism is a state of society in which diverse groups maintain their culture or interest. We're living in a pluralistic society. And you've seen the bumper stickers and possibly seen it other places. Seen this? Coexist. That was originally just had the first sign, which is for Islam, and then the Star of David, and then the cross. And it was designed by a Polish artist for a contest. But then it's been added, you know, now it has symbols that indicate paganism and I don't know what else. But this is what our culture believes they want. They believe that if we just go along to get along, everything would be much better. Especially if Christians would go along to get along, everything would be much better. Tolerance is the highest virtue. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you keep it to yourself. Okay, and that's only step one. What we all really need to do is celebrate our differences. Never try to change anyone. So just join in with the big party that Nebuchadnezzar sets up. I mean, this was not just a time to worship. They had a big party, no doubt, or at least that was planned. But what got Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego into trouble was their refusal to make their faith subject to the culture. They refused to privatize it, is how we put it in the first lesson. So as we saw in several New Testament letters to churches, it's not a matter of being rude and intolerant. And as we saw in the last lesson from Daniel, we should also be careful to use tact when we disagree with our culture and show compassion even for those who may regard us as competitors or even enemies. But think about Daniel. Daniel actually saved the lives of these jerks who reported Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to try to get them out of their way so that they could move up the ladder of prominence. So go back and read Daniel 2 if you weren't here week before last. Daniel saved the lives of all of the wise men of Babylon. They were all going to be executed, including Daniel, Shadrach, and Meshach, and Abednego. And even though Daniel was apparently not present in this situation, we don't know exactly where Daniel was, but he was apparently not present, but they knew that he was also a Jew. Or maybe he was present somewhere at the occasion, but these guys who were accusing Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were afraid to include Daniel in the accusation because, after all, he was their boss. So I'm sure, though, that Daniel did not bow down to the idol wherever he was at the time. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were the ones who took the heat this time. I'll let that soak in. Took the heat. You get it. Okay. So here's the line that makes us think that this guy is a slow learner. If you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? Seriously? I mean, what happened to surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings? But there's the challenge. And these guys give him a reminder of what he should have known. But maybe his polytheistic brain, the one that thinks in terms of the more gods you worship, the safer you are. That's how his brain worked. Maybe that is obvious. Maybe what is obvious to us has never sunken into that brain. Okay? So here's either a reminder of what he did learn but has not retained, or this is a reality that had not quite dawned on him. Even though he believed their God was the God of gods, he still believed in the other gods. So here's what they said in response to his challenge. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. Okay, now, that first line is something that he should have known. He should have known that the God of gods was able to deliver them. What he did not know is what they didn't really know at this point. At least we have no record of God or an angel from heaven, you know, telling them that God was going to rescue them. We don't have any record of that. They believed that God would deliver them, but how did they know? We certainly don't know if anything like that had ever happened. We don't have any record of it. It wasn't something based on a direct promise that if this ever happens and you do this, then you'll be rescued. And so we know that their response was based on faith. Now, was this what we would call a blind faith? No, it was not. It was faith that was based on their experience. When they were faithful to God's food laws instead of the king's plan, God turned it into not just a survival in the midst of persecution, he turned it into a victory. The king himself said that they were 10 times smarter than all of the others after that incident. And when their friend Daniel took the challenge and went into the king to ask for time to interpret the dream when they were all under an order of execution, they prayed. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego prayed with Daniel. He went to them, and it all turned into an even greater victory. And that's how they were now in charge of the provinces around Babylon that made them the objects of the envy of the other wise men. So it wasn't blind faith. It was a pretty well-informed faith, but still just faith. And their next words are some of the best that we might find in all of Scripture. And we need to think about these words and how they could apply to us. But even if he does not deliver us, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Those words tell us that they were acting on faith, even if he does not. But that next line is so different from anything that I might have said. We want you to know. We want you to know. Would you have wanted him to know? I might not have wanted him to know. Let him draw his own conclusions, you know, about what would happen if he didn't. This is how I would rather deal with issues that are completely at odds with our culture in general, you know, when I face these. I mean, sex outside of marriage between a man and a woman, you know, unless I'm asked a direct question, I'd rather not offend anyone. You know, I might feel obligated to answer the question if I was asked it, but I'm not sure that when I'm not within, you know, the community of faith that believes like I do, when I'm out in the culture, I'm not sure I can honestly say that I want everyone to know everything that I disagree about, you know, as to our beliefs, my beliefs, and our culture. I do believe that I'm right in wanting to be as gentle and loving as possible towards sinners, like Jesus was, but he did say, go and sin no more. Now, I'd rather not have to say that. So the truth may be that I really just don't like conflict. I have to examine myself. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said this to a man who at least thought he had the power of life and death over them. Turned out he didn't. But he was already furious with rage. And they say this. This doesn't seem to be such a smart move on their part. Now, something that we might not have noticed is that they do show respect to him in the way they address him, even as they say this. They use the proper term, Your Majesty. They didn't say, listen, jerk face, you know, you only think you're important. This was a stupid idea, and you are an idiot. You know, they didn't avoid that language because they were trying to avoid conflict. They actually avoided it because they did understand that God had put Nebuchadnezzar in the position he was in, even if he was far from worthy. Look back at Daniel's interpretation of his dream in chapter 2. This was the dream, and now we will interpret it to the king. Your Majesty, you are the King of Kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory. In your hands he has placed all mankind, including Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the beasts of the field and the birds in the sky. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. So these great men of faith in the one true God showed respect to this evil king, even in the middle of his evil plan, out of honor, not to him, but to God's plan. They must have lived every day wondering why in the world God chose this man. But they knew that he was God's choice. And if he did evil and squandered all of the good, you know, the opportunities to do good that he had, that was between him and God. And by the way, we will see a reckoning as we continue in this book, you know, between Nebuchadnezzar and God. But here's a lesson that we may really need to come to grips with in this crazy election season, okay? Our part is to humbly make the best choices that we can and try to let the Spirit of Christ live in us in spite of all of the nonsense and hatefulness and meanness and stupidity. God did not make us the judges of anyone in our culture, not even the politicians who make themselves such easy targets. We do have to make judgments as to behaviors. That's not judging hearts or judging someone's relationship with God or judging how they should be punished. Those are the things that we don't do as judge, you know, not judges. We can and must say, for instance, that lying is wrong. Murder is wrong. Gossip is wrong. Some sexual behaviors are wrong. Greed is wrong. Hate is wrong. But what we must not do is say things like, this person cares only about himself or herself. That person only takes this position to get votes. We don't. It's okay to look at someone's record and say the evidence would suggest this or that, so I have to choose the safest guess as to what he or she would do. That's the position we're in. We can only guess. We should also look at the policies and say this idea does not make sense to me, or that idea does not seem to respect God's principles or truths. We just need to avoid making judgments of the heart. Paul even pointed out that we do not even know our own hearts, much less the hearts of people around us. Look at this. This is in 1 Corinthians. Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. Well, that was in Paul's case, him and the apostles. But in Nebuchadnezzar's case, in our politician's case, that's between them and God. They need to prove faithful. But Paul says, I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that doesn't make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Okay. So Nebuchadnezzar orders the fire to be stoked up to 7 times hotter than usual. Now, I don't know whether this was a typical punishment that was used by Nebuchadnezzar's regime, but I guess that that's exactly what it was. And that illustrates just how violent and how brutal this king was. I mean, if you could make arguments against obedience or respect for earthly governments, I mean, this would certainly be a pretty strong argument. Look at what kind of government does this. But I would speculate that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego may have had every chance while it was heating up and while they were being tied up to change their minds, you know, and beg for mercy and bow down to his idol. And Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he favored their friend Daniel very clearly, and he had gone with Daniel's recommendation to put them in the positions they were in. So he probably was hoping that they would do something that would allow him to save them while saving face himself. That does not happen. They are tied up and taken to be thrown into the fire. It is so hot that the men who are throwing them in die from the heat. Then two remarkable, unprecedented things happen. The first is that they walk around in the furnace, and the ropes have apparently burned, but their clothes have not burned, and they're just walking around. The second is that there is a fourth person in there with them. Who is this person, and where did he come from? Nebuchadnezzar has a nomination. He said, look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods. Now, his polytheistic brain that believes in many gods, even though he did say that Daniel's God is the God over all of them, that brain still uses that polytheistic language. I mean, he looks like a son of the gods. But I do believe that we should change a couple of words, but agree with his impression. I believe that he was the son of the one God. Now, this is what is called a theophany, or more specifically, a Christophany. You may be thinking, of course, I was thinking the same thing. Maybe not. But maybe you were and you just didn't know the words. Theophany means God appearing to humans before the incarnation, before Jesus became a man. Or a Christophany is more specific, Christ appearing to humans also before he became a man. There are times when God appeared to Moses and Elijah and others that appear to be God the Father, at least to some. And there are times when an angel is called the angel of the Lord. And that seems to be Jesus. If an angel is worshipped in the Old Testament, it is not just a messenger from God, as is the basic term angel means. It is God himself, if he's worshipped. You don't worship angels. Go and read Jude and 2 Peter. You know, that's a big no-no. You don't worship angels. But so when he is worshipped, it is God himself as one personality or the other, the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Don't get too caught up in this, though, because it's not really a clear teaching that is laid out for us. So we apparently don't need to understand it completely. I don't think we could understand it completely. It's just a reasonable observation. And it is so reasonable that our slow learner Nebuchadnezzar draws that conclusion. What is important in this is the reality that whether this was just an angel or it was Jesus himself before he let go of equality with God and became a human like us, who would have been consumed by this fire as a human, the reality is that when we are faithful, God is with us. He doesn't just care for us at a safe distance. He's not just cheering us on with words. He is right here with us, keeping us from being consumed in whatever fire of life that threatens to consume us. And the result of this is praise for God. Look at, again, at how explicit Nebuchadnezzar is in his praise. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God." Now, you might think that he would have downplayed the fact that they defied his order, you know? We don't want to encourage this kind of thing after all, you know? But no, he knew that this was not something that worshipers of other gods would even try. You know, they weren't going to say, "Our gods will save us. Go ahead and throw us in the fire." In fact, he does set God apart in what was for him pretty remarkable. "Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way." Did God need or want Nebuchadnezzar's help to defend his sovereignty? No. Did God want people to worship him out of fear of being cut into pieces and leaving nothing behind but piles of rubble? I don't think so. But is there anything that we should follow in Nebuchadnezzar's response? I think we would do well to watch out what we say when we question why God allows evil and suffering in our world. We can ask questions, like Job did when he suffered, but we must avoid accusations, as Job did. We should never curse God and die, as Job's wife suggested he should. All right, so our takeaways are, first of all, trust in God's desire to reward faithfulness. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego showed great strength when they resisted the pressure to go along, to get along, but the king then promoted them to even greater positions of trust and influence. Now, it may not always be that immediate or that obvious, but when we are trustworthy, we will be entrusted with more opportunities to serve. Next, do not place conditions on our obedience. We have to get past the notion that we can put conditions on our obedience. We can't bargain with God ahead of time and say, you know, "If you will do this for me, then I will be faithful to you." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego believed that God would rescue them, but their obedience was not conditioned on that belief. Even if he does not save us, we will only worship him. We might not ever say that we will only be faithful to God if he is faithful to us in the ways that we want him to be faithful, but we sometimes question God's faithfulness when things don't work out the way that we want, or when we suffer. And we might think, we might even say, you know, "I've been faithful all these years or all these times, so why is this happening to me?" You know, that's the way our culture tends to think. In many cultures, in our world today, suffering is expected. I mean, it's just a part of life. They expect it. But in America, we look for someone to blame for everything. You know, we don't have to suffer, and if we can't find someone to blame on earth, we'll blame God. We don't accept that we're supposed to suffer. As followers of Jesus who are living in this culture, here's the question. If we're following a man who was brutally murdered for us, why do we expect to live a life free of suffering? That's who we follow. If we suffer, we do it to his glory. If he saves us from suffering like he did for them, we do that to his glory. Okay, so next. Wording's a little awkward. We need to desire for others to know when we stand with God against our culture. They said, "We want you to know that we will not worship your gods." Do we want people to know that we do not worship the gods of money, power, and pleasure? Those are the gods our culture worships. If our choices are all about how we can gain more influence or satisfaction in those three arenas, and our neighbors see us gaining and keeping more money and influence and seeking more physical pleasures in the same ways that they do, we will not be change agents for God in this world. When we do gain money, power, and enjoy marriage relationships that include sexual pleasure, we must see those things as blessings to be used to God's glory and use those blessings for others first. Now, be careful with this one too, because if we use preachy sounding language even as we bless others, some will actually be turned away. You can say, well, that's on them, but as Peter instructed wives of non-believers, read this a couple of weeks ago, often the best way to win others over is simply by our lives rather than through words. We need to be humble, especially when we help others. And then finally, we need to take comfort in knowing that God is with us in the flames of life. When we're in the fiery furnaces of life, Jesus is right there with us. He's not up in heaven taking care of us. He's with us. We're walking around in our broken lives, in this broken world, maybe even being blamed for everything that is wrong in our lives or everything that is wrong in this world. But Jesus is there with us, and we're just walking around going about our business as if there were no fire at all. Our hair is not singed. Our clothes don't even smell like smoke. I'm not sure what fuels would have been used to make that furnace 7 times hotter. Have you thought about that? Pretty sure it's not firewood. In that region, that's now Iran. It might easily have been some petroleum product, that bubbled to the surface, or coal. And smoke from those is considerably worse smelling than wood smoke, but I'm guessing it was actually sulfur, which is about the worst. Burning sulfur is called brimstone in some older Bible versions. Sulfur doesn't burn as hot as acetylene or some other gases that we have today, but it burned very hot compared to most fuels they had then. And if it smells about as bad as anything that you will ever smell. But the clothes of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't even smell smoky at all. Now, to some in our culture, we are stinking the place up. I mean, that's what they think. But when we are humble and faithful, we can be like our three heroes. Listen to what Peter reminds us in another passage. Dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were foreigners and exiles in Babylon. We are foreigners and exiles in our world. We are living in Babylon. But we can live such good lives that others see our good deeds and glorify God. Let's pray.